Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Jeremy Waldron, university professor at New York University Law School, speaks on the topic whether it's ever appropriate for American judges to be influenced in their decision by what they know of the laws of other countries. The Storrs Lectures, one of Yale Law School's oldest and most prestigious lecture programs, addresses fundamental problems of law and jurisprudence. This is Lecture 3 of a three-part lecture series.
So the title of the talk today, Learning from Other Courts, The Right Way, The Wrong Way, and The Legal Way. Some of you may be familiar with the case of President of the Republic against Hugo, a 1997 constitutional case from South Africa. When Nelson Mandela became our President of South Africa, one of the first things he did was issue an order, a sort of pardon or amnesty, freeing all mothers who were in prison on the 10th of May 1994, all mothers who had minor children under the age of 12 years old. Mr. Hugo, who was not a mother, but who did have an 11-year-old son whose mother had died, was serving a prison sentence, and he brought suit alleging that the president's action violated the interim constitution of South Africa by discriminating unfairly against him and similar people on grounds of sex or gender. So the matter came to the South African Constitutional Court, and it presented a very intriguing tangle of issues. Is something like a presidential pardon reviewable for failing to conform to a general constitutional standard? Can an act of mercy be discriminatory or unfair if the applicant has no right to it? And if, as is clear in a country where male prisoners outnumber female prisoners by 50-1, where an insistence that men and women be treated equally in this regard might well lead to no amnesty at all? Given that women usually occupy a subordinate role in South African families, and given that they almost always have primary responsibility for the upbringing of children, can it really be said that any formal discrimination here is unfair against a man for a measure seeking to benefit women specifically in a family context? If the president's order is an infringement of the right to non-discrimination, is it a justifiable infringement in terms of the provision which in South Africa, as we saw yesterday in New Zealand, you find in the Bill of Rights allowing the rights to be limited by laws of general application, provided that such limitation is reasonable and justifiable in a democratic society? Can an act of amnesty be regarded as a law of general application for these purposes? And so on and so on. Whole series of tangled, interrelated issues. One of the striking things about the list of issues that I've mentioned is that on every one of them, Richard Goldstone, who wrote for the court, and his fellow judges, some concurring in his decision, some dissenting. On each issue, the judges of the South African Constitutional Court referred in detail to the law of other jurisdictions. Their opinions are riddled with references to foreign law. They refer to American, German, Irish, British, Australian, New Zealand law on the judicial reviewability of prerogative or executive action and the reviewability of the power to pardon. They chart a sea change in world constitutionalism to bring the last of the executive's prerogative powers under the supervision of the rule of law. They refer to Canadian and European authority on the meaning of discrimination and on its relation to the value of dignity. Actually, the first time I came across this case was when I was doing some work on dignity and groups for a lecture I gave in Cape Town in July. So I really didn't come across it. I just adapted it for the use in this lecture. But it seemed to me to illustrate, the effortless nature of the reference to foreign law. And several of the judges who applied the reasonable limitation clause cited Canadian cases as authority for the proposition that something like a presidential order could be regarded as a law of general application. The outcome was that the court declined to overturn the president's decree. The majority, that's seven judges, because although the measure formally discriminated against Mr. Hugo, it didn't do so unfairly. They said the presumption of unfairness was rebutted by the fact that men did not suffer the loss of any right or legal advantage to which they would otherwise have been entitled. Three judges thought the measure was unfairly discriminatory, but one of them argued that as a general measure it was nevertheless reasonable and justifiable according to the limitation clause, so that led to only two dissenters. The fact that the South African court devoted so much attention to foreign law should come as no surprise to anyone who's familiar with its constitutional position. Section 35 of the interim constitution under which Hugo was decided laid down that in interpreting the provisions of this chapter, that is the Bill of Rights, a court of law shall, where applicable, have regard to public international law applicable to the protection of the rights entrenched in this chapter, shall have regard to international law, and may have regard to comparable foreign case law. That's specifically laid down in the interim constitution. It's continued in Article 39 of the present constitution of South Africa. And you might say that this puts South Africa in a wholly different position from that of our Supreme Court. They are explicitly permitted to cite foreign law, whereas there is no such explicit permission in the US Constitution, and if some congressmen had their way, there would be an explicit prohibition. Still, it's worth asking what are the reasons that underlie the explicit permission in South Africa, and if we figure out those reasons, we could ask whether those reasons have any application as reasons in countries like the United States that don't have such an explicit clause. I need hardly add that we shouldn't say that the existence of Article 39 of the South African Constitution shows that it's inappropriate to consider comparable foreign case law without such an explicit permission. Interpretation clauses are often not intended to create anything new, but merely to make explicit for the purpose of removing any doubt principles of interpretation which may well have been applicable all along. Just one other comment on this. Those involved in the drafting of the Constitution have told me that many of the reasons for including this provision are similar to some arguments I pursued at the end of yesterday's lecture. It was felt important to identify the new South Africa explicitly with the opinions and practices of the rest of the rights-respecting community in the world, and to leave no doubt that their country and its new constitutional order intended to reverse the pariah status, the alienation from the global consensus on human rights that had been characteristic of the apartheid decades. Okay, so there's Hugo, and we'll use it as a point of reference in these lectures. Yesterday, I mentioned two broad strategies for defending citation of foreign law in constitutional cases. One was the approach I used in my 2005 Harvard Law Review piece, emphasizing the epistemic benefits of looking beyond American law. The idea is that we can learn from what other courts are doing when they are addressing questions which are the same or similar to the questions we are addressing. The other strategy involved the more elusive idea that there might be some virtue in sheer consistency across decisions, even when courts belong to different jurisdictions, and it was that second set of ideas, consistency, fairness, integrity, that we explored last evening. But it's time now to say something about the epistemic approach, as Robert said, learning and reason as justifications for the citation of foreign law. The epistemic approach seems to be what the US justices have in mind when they defend their practice in this regard. Justice Ginsburg has said that foreign opinions can add to the store of knowledge relevant to the solution of trying questions. Justice O'Connor believes there's much to learn from other distinguished jurists who have given thought to the same difficult issues we face here. Justice Breyer talks of the enormous value in any discipline of trying to learn from the similar experience of others. And he says the practice involves opening your eyes to what is going on elsewhere, taking what you learn for what it is worth, and using it as a point of comparison where doing so will prove helpful. Foreign judges evidently believe that they have something to learn from their American counterparts. You see that in Hopkinson, you see that in Hugo. And so the American judges say we ought to be humble enough to accept that there might be lessons to be learned in the opposite direction as well. If we leave it like that, we haven't got very much further than just the vague and cheerful idea of continuing judicial education. Like many of the faculty members in the room, I go to those resorts and talk to the judges here and particularly in New Zealand. And I hope they learn something from what I say. I wouldn't expect them to cite to what I say or give it any authority. I have heard it said that one of the main values associated with the citation of foreign law is a sort of scholarly value of acknowledgement and transparency. Since judges are bound to learn something from all the foreign junkets they attend, they ought to be upfront with us and actually include a footnote not pretend that this is something they made up themselves. But an opinion is not a law review article, and a citation is not an acknowledgement to one's friends. A judicial opinion is a formal state document, and a citation is a marker of something that is given and is to be given weight. I don't quite want to adopt the line taken by a congressman in conversation with Stephen Breyer. Justice Breyer told an audience at NYU that he said to the congressman, "Look, Congressman, if I have a difficult case and a judge of a different country had to consider a similar problem, why should I not read what that judge has said? It will not bind me, but I may learn something." And the congressman replied, "Well, fine, you're right, read it. Just don't cite it in your opinion." And I don't know whether you know this conversation, but Breyer went on and he said something to the effect, "Moreover, Congressman, you know, some of these courts in other countries are struggling to gain legitimacy in the eyes of their own people, and a citation by the U.S. Supreme Court can be tremendously encouraging to them." And the congressman said, "Fine, write them a letter, but don't, but don't put it in your opinion." I'd like to offer a slightly less casual version of the epistemic approach. No doubt we can learn things from all sorts of places. Possibilities are unlimited. We can probably learn something from reading Harry Potter. But a defense of the use of foreign law ought to be more specific, and I think more legalistic than this. It ought to be more reflective, too, on the relationship between this process of learning and the underlying philosophy of legal reasoning, and that's what I want to talk about. The first question is this: are we supposed to learn something simply from the sheer fact of decision by the foreign court, from its outcome, from its conclusions, or are we supposed to learn something from its reasoning? Is it conclusion or argument that our judges are supposed to learn from? In his contribution to the Harvard Law Review Symposium that I also participated in, Ernest Young said this about Roper against Simmons. "Roper does not read like a case in which the court looked abroad hoping to learn something. Justice Kennedy's discussion of foreign law is all about nose counting, counting heads, not about reasons. It begins with, quote, the stark reality that the U.S. is the only country in the world that continues to give official sanction to the juvenile death penalty. It continues that only 7 countries other than the U.S. have executed juvenile offenders since 1990. The only country discussed in any detail, says Young, is the United Kingdom. And again, this point is simply the fact of abolition. No inquiry is made into why the U.K. might have taken such a step. He says this lack of interest in the reasons is characteristic of the court's employment of foreign law. The judges are not searching foreign court opinions for innovative doctrinal formulae or new arguments. There is none of Vicky Jackson's," Vicky was one of the other symposiasts, "there's none of Vicky Jackson's engagement with the foreign arguments in Roper, nor did the court use foreign law as a repository of common wisdom in the manner of Waldron's Jus Gentium. They simply discounted up the decisions." And this sort of head-counting practice that Young observed does seem perhaps more consonant with the consistency argument we explored yesterday than with the reasoning argument I wanted to explore today. Cass Sunstein, whom I admire greatly, and Eric Posner have made a valiant attempt to reconcile Young's observations with the possibility of epistemic benefits from recourse to foreign law. In an article recently published in the Stanford Law Review, they invoke Condorcet's jury theorem, and they argue that our justices may be more likely to get to the right answer in some difficult case if they follow the lead of a majority of foreign courts who have reasoned independently to the same result than if they try to figure it out by themselves. On the Condorcet approach, the reasoning doesn't matter. The only thing that matters are the decisions of the foreign courts. All we need is some assurance that the average foreign court is more likely than not to get to the right answer. If the average court, foreign court is more likely or not than not to get to the right answer, then the probability that a majority of foreign courts will have the right answer is somewhat higher than that. It's a sort of typical Condorcet arithmetic. So that, you know, just to give you an example, if you have, if I'm trying to decide the case and there are 2 foreign courts and we all have 0.6 chance of getting to the right answer, each of us, if we're deciding it by ourselves, then the chance that a majority of the 3 of us will get to the right answer is 0.648. And if it's 5 of us, it goes up to 0.6825. And if it's 41 of us, it goes up to about 0.9. just simply by the, again, by the mechanics of the arithmetic, provided you start with these individual values. It's an intriguing application, though. As an opponent of judicial review, I can't resist saying that if you wanted to follow the Condorcet theorem, you might hesitate about having these matters decided by courts in the first place. We already have very large numbers of people voting in legislatures on these matters, and unless you are savagely pessimistic about democratic competence, that is about these numbers at the top, as actually Condorcet was, then you'd expect majority voting among legislators to be more likely to yield a good result than the majority of the decisions of a few dozen courts. Also, and this again is a more playful comment, I'm not entirely sure Condorcet's approach is going to convince many of the congressional skeptics about the citation of foreign law. They may accept that foreign courts are on average more likely than not to get it right. They may not accept that foreign courts are on average more likely than not to get it right about important constitutional issues, but they may think that foreign decisions share other attributes which the Condorcet arithmetic will magnify. Because remember, Condorcet's arithmetic has nothing to do with truth. It just says if there is a 0.6 chance that this decision is T, then there is a 0.648 chance that the majority of the three decisions will be T. Now, T could stand for true, right? But T could also stand for obtuse, long-winded, effete, excessively liberal, unlikely to prove acceptable to Americans, and so on. T could be 5 pages long or something like that. It's just simply a mechanical formulation. It has no real epistemic substance to it whatsoever. So I want to put that to one side. Let's go back to the question of whether we're supposed to learn from the holding or the reasoning of the foreign courts. The South African case I began with illustrates the second possibility. I thought the New Zealand flag burning case did too. There's all sorts of things that go into judicial reasoning. Concepts, empirical evidence, doctrinal tests, lines of argumentation, rules, principles, balancing, precedents, interpretive strategies, moral values, and so on. What category of knowledge is supposed to be accessible by recourse to the reasoning of foreign courts? To use a Foucauldian barbarism, what is the episteme of this epistemic argument? Is it an episteme of empirical social science? Is it an episteme of moral philosophy? What is it exactly? What domain is this learning supposed to be in? Is it that we can gain empirical insight? I'm not sure. There was some empirical argument in Roper against Simmons about child development and the development of moral responsibility for the juvenile murderer. But the court didn't learn that from the foreign cases. It already had that well in hand before the reference to the foreign cases came up. In his dissent in a federalism case, Prince against the United States, from 1997, Justice Breyer suggested that we can learn something about the effects of law, the effect of certain legal solutions, from considering foreign experience. He says, foreign experience may cast an empirical light on the consequences of different solutions to a common legal problem. It was a federalism case, and he said, well, we go around saying things about the relationship between federal structure and liberty. Wouldn't it be worth looking at the experience of alternative federal structures elsewhere, like Switzerland or other countries, Australia, to see what the different consequences for liberty of the various structures are? And Sir Basil Marcassinus and Jörg Fedke have offered a similar suggestion in their book, Judicial Recourse to Foreign Law, a book to which Justice Barak contributed. They have a chapter entitled, When Should Such Dialogue Take Place? And it has subsections called When Foreign Experience Helps Disprove Locally Expressed Fears About the Consequences of a Particular Legal Solution, and When the Foreign Law Provides Additional Evidence That a Proposed Solution Has Worked in Other Systems. Point sounds perfectly reasonable, though, as Justice Scalia says, it might be more relevant to the task of drafting a constitution than to the task of interpreting the one with which we are stuck, on his account. But even if you believe that we are doing genuine evaluation of structural alternatives in our constitutional adjudication, I guess you might want to ask, how are you supposed to get empirical information simply by looking at foreign law? I mean, you're going to get sort of vague Montesquieuian impressions of different schemes, but surely what we would really want is a proper study by political scientists or law and society people, and it's not clear that that is what Breyer had in mind. Consider some other possibilities, maybe not an empirical episteme, but a moral episteme. Are we supposed to learn morally from recourse to foreign law? Did the court in Roper learn morally anything about the death penalty or the juvenile death? I don't think so. They knew the pros and cons of that fairly well. There might be something to be learned about the moral attitudes of other countries. It comes as a surprise to many Americans that life imprisonment without parole is usually regarded also as a violation of human rights, and most certainly a violation of human rights in the case of juveniles. And it's not so much that we learn anything from that, but it stops us in our tracks a little bit and perhaps makes us reflect on the fact that most of us present this as a reasonable alternative to execution. Look, in my view, the most interesting understanding of the episteme involved in our court's use of foreign law is not empirical, not general public policy, not moral philosophy, pure or applied. It is rather a specifically legal episteme. We stand to gain in terms of our acquisition and our ability to manipulate specifically legal knowledge, and that's what I want to focus on for the rest of this lecture. Go back to my title. There's a saying in the military when some problem crops up and has to be dealt with that, well, there's the right way of dealing with it, the wrong way of dealing with it, and the army way of dealing with it. And in public policy circles, it might be said that there's a right way of dealing with a problem and a wrong way of dealing with a problem, or at least better or worse ways. And in addition, there is the lawyer's way. Is the legal way of dealing with the problem. Lawyers, I don't mean this in any sort of derogatory sense, lawyers have their own particular approach to the problems that they're called on to grapple with. It's not primarily empirical, though it identifies the place for the insertion of empirical information at various points, nor is it just moral argument or moral advocacy. It's a method of analysis, of taking some problem apart, abstracting various issues from their concrete setting in the problem, and then reformulating the problem step by step as an ordered series of tests that apply various nested, interlocking, and sometimes competing principles. That's what we do. That's what we're trained to do, is take a complex situation apart and deal with it step by step. So putting it very, very crudely and almost certainly unfairly, apologies to any Texans and Belgians in the audience, I could imagine somebody saying on the execution of juveniles or people for crimes committed when they were juveniles, well, there's the Texas way, string them up as soon as they reach the age of majority. And there's the Belgian way, put them for a few months in a motel-like facility with occupational therapy and then release them. And then there's the legal way. And it doesn't much matter whether the lawyers and judges who exemplify the legal way come from Texas or from Belgium or from somewhere else, they will quickly disclose their training as lawyers and they'll be recognizable as such to other lawyers from all over the world. Put this problem of the punishment of adult offenders for crimes committed when they were children in front of a lawyer, and she will carefully take apart the issue, separating the application of various principles and ideas from one another, laying out in some logical order a series of hard, interlocking, and quite abstract questions about the nature of culpability, about cognitive and moral development, about the use of bright lines like an age of majority to characterize a gradual process, about the different functions of adult and juvenile courts, about the interorum effects of being tried as an adult, about the general purposes of punishment, the rights of victims and their families, the impact of punishment on a young person, particularly in the way that it relates some individual action to outcomes over the whole course of their life, the different elements in mental culpability, including choice, intention, moral understanding, cognition, understanding of the action and its consequences for others, particularly the victim, understanding the act and its consequences for oneself, the connection between all that and the capacity to foresee the long-term impact of punishment, the purpose of having an array of punishments ranked from the least severe to the most severe, the particular significance of what I called yesterday or the day before, I forget which, totalizing punishments, punishments that are intended to affect or blight the whole of a person's life, like the death penalty, or like life imprisonment without parole, or like any reasonable sentence of life imprisonment, rather than just be an unwanted episode. The nature and safeguards of whatever accompanying discretion is vested in a court, and so on and so on. There's a whole list of issues that interlock here, and a good lawyer will begin identify these, take them apart, and try and reorder them, synthesize them in a step-by-step order. Try and figure out a way through this maze of articulated issues. I say that something like this analysis is typical of lawyerly thinking and lawyers' mentality the world over, and we can recognize someone as a lawyer as much by her use of this method as by her citation of texts, codes, statutes, and precedents, though normally we would expect to see both. No doubt lawyers from different jurisdictions will work through the issues in different ways, depending on how they've been taught and the arrays of precedents they're familiar with, or the particular structure of the code that they have in their country, but nevertheless, something like this, abstraction and identification of separable issues, and then putting them together in some sort of ordered way, is typical of law. And I say, I think it's recognizable even at a jurisdictional distance. I'm probably overstating it a bit. There are judges and law professors who say we should abandon any pretense that there's a distinctive episteme here, any autonomous way of doing this. They think we should just retool ourselves and move to something more like direct public policy advocacy or economic analysis. For anyone in this category, and there are probably some in the room, what I'm saying will be unconvincing, or more than usually unconvincing. For them, the learning that takes place when American judges consult foreign sources can only be empirical or public policy learning. It can't be anything distinctively legal. And certainly you wouldn't want to push the line I'm taking too far. Though I have in mind specifically legal learning, I'm not predicating my argument on any sort of wholesale resurrection of doctrinal formalism of a sort of Langdalian type. If we are summoning up this idea of a legal episteme and imagine judges taking lessons in it from one another across jurisdictional lines, we must show that it's more than just a word game. But I actually do think there is substance involved in this. Part of what's going on when we draw these abstract issues out of a concrete problem, it's not abstraction for its own sake, is that it has to do with some of the things we talked about yesterday. We want to look deeply rather than superficially at congruences and likenesses and unlikenesses between situations. And the categories of analysis that we use enable us to do that. But more than that, we also want to be, we are aware as lawyers both in our own thinking about justice and in our application of society's thinking about justice, that justice has to be sensitive in a fine-grained way to a number of different facets of situations. And we want to identify and abstract each facet that may be relevant to the just distribution of the case, either as we see it or as lawyers in the way that society sees it, so that everything that society regards as relevant to justice is identified, labeled, and then related systematically to the other things that it sees as related to justice. So there's not just a word game. This mode of abstraction, analysis, and reordering, I think, is tremendously, tremendously important. And I think you can see something like this going on in Hopkinson against the police, the flag-burning case yesterday, when Ellen France went step by step through what we would see as a constitutional analysis of the situation to make sure she didn't miss anything that might be important for justice, to make sure she got the issues in the right order. And you see it, I think, particularly in the Hugo case, which I've just briefly spoken about, but you can read it. The judges on the South African Constitutional Court wanted to be sure that they dealt justly with all the nuances of fairness and unfairness and discrimination and equality in the president's action, not to mention the structural issues of the reviewability of prerogative action. This looks like a particular act of mercy, but is it more like a general statute? What's it like? We have to abstract a little bit from it and look at the different categories that are relevant for it. So foreign law was cited again and again in these judgments for the clues that it offered for things we should be alert to and pathways of ordering them, or pathways of figuring out this complicated tangle of issues. Hugo and Hopkinson involve other countries learning from us. and that's as it should be. We've developed a very good and complicated repertoire of ways of figuring through complicated issues in this country. I read somewhere, I think it was an observation by Jack Goldsmith, that we've developed such a good repertoire here that we can make this available to other courts. We can be lenders, but we shouldn't be borrowers. You know, we have such good doctrine already that we don't want to contaminate it with the cruder impulses of liberal European jurisprudence. I don't really want to say anything about that, except what I said about cruel and unusual punishment yesterday. But I will say, I mean, I'm trying to work partly generally, partly specifically in this case, and as Sunstein and Posner put it, the question whether one country should consult the law of other countries is much larger and more interesting than the question whether the US Supreme Court should consult the law of other courts. I mean, for us, this is the important question, but there was also the general jurisprudence question of what in general might societies have to learn from one another in this way. Missing out a whole lot of stuff about the Queen here. Let me try to relate all this now to the idea of jus gentium. Because so far, I've just given you some examples of just sort of picking up some modes of analysis and modes of ordering and figuring out complicated issues from one society to another. In my Harvard piece, I used as an analogy to the jus gentium, the consensus that is shared at any given period among members of the scientific community. I've long been intrigued by what you might call the cosmopolitanism of scientists, the way scientists, physicists, chemists, biologists, talk about what we know, or what we have established, and what we are still working with, where the we doesn't just mean me and my friends, and doesn't just mean me and other scientists at my university or even in my country, but the we refers to the general community of scientists in the world, understood collectively. We think the Big Bang happened some 10 or 20 billion years ago, but the one or two inconsistencies in the theory that we haven't figured out yet. We have a pretty good idea of what causes AIDS and how to mitigate its progress, but we don't have anything yet in the way of a good theory of vaccination for this disease. We, the community of scientists as a whole. The we refers to the consensus of that community, scientists who read the same literature, are aware of one another's work, check and recheck one another's experimental results, that is, try to reduplicate the experiments and report whether they can reduplicate them or whether they can't, grapple with problems, operate peer-reviewed journals, go to conferences, and so on. It's a wonderful notion, not least because it involves a cosmopolitan, almost a worldwide concept of community, a civilization-wide connection, certainly, among humans working together. Not with any sort of political institutions, it has structure. There certainly are institutions like journals and learned societies and so on, but it's a participatory cosmopolitan community. So there is the community of scientists and there is their consensus for the time being on which theories are valid, which explanations adequate, which empirical results reliable, what the current state of play is, which problems are still unresolved or intractable. No doubt the consensus is loose. Certainly it's continually evolving. But every scientist the world over thinks and works and orients him or herself towards this consensus and the community that sustains it. Well, I think there is an analogy to be drawn between the law of nations, jus gentium, and the established body of scientific findings. I said that existing science claims neither unanimity among scientists nor infallibility, but that nevertheless the consensus I have described stands as a repository of enormous importance to individual researchers and laboratories as they go about their work. And it's unthinkable that any professional, hardworking scientist would proceed without making some contact or having some access to the body of existing research without drawing on that. And similarly, I want to suggest that the jus gentium, conceived as a sort of consensual clearinghouse for the kinds of ideas, abstractions, distinctions, and lines of legalistic argument that I've been referring to, makes itself available to lawmakers and judges as an established body of legal insight, reminding them that their particular problem has been confronted before and that they, like the scientists, should not just strike out on their own, but try and think the problem through in the company of others who have dealt with it already. Justice Thomas has been heard to complain about foreign fads and fashions becoming too dominant in our law. And I suppose there would be a similar concern about the scientific community. Some of those who have worked in the wake of Thomas Kuhn's work about paradigms becoming dominant and oppressively so might worry about fads and fashions, unfairly crowding out new scientific ideas. I don't want to deny that there are outliers, and sometimes there are honorable outliers with regard to both types of consensus. But nevertheless, it remains the case that good professional work in both disciplines is done under the auspices of this consensus. Look, I don't want this to be misunderstood. I'm not proposing a consensus theory of truth, right? On the contrary, the scientific community's consensus for the time being is always understood to be fallible, and it's judgeable in the last analysis by criteria of external truth. I'm an objectivist about the world that the scientists are trying to describe and explain. Some people might not be, but I don't want to get into an argument about that here. But it's precisely because we are trying to explain a mind-independent world that we think it's so important to check each other's results, that we think it's so important to have an organized way of checking each other's results. The consensus in the community I have in mind comprises not just an accumulation of authorities, but a dense network of checking and rechecking results, experimental duplication, credentialing, mutual elaboration, and building on one another's work. Neither of these communities in law or in physics offers any guarantees so far as the overall aim of the enterprise is concerned, truth in the case of science, justice in the case of law. A consensus in either field can be wrong. Still, in neither field is there a sensible alternative to orienting oneself to the established body of available intellectual resources. And the other way, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not suggesting that law and science share a methodology. I'm really talking about institutional structure, really, and consensus, but not methodology. Laurie Ackerman of the, not Bruce, but Laurie Ackerman of the South African Constitutional Court says, well, there may be something in common between scientific methodology and legal methodology. And he cites the importance of Karl Popper's and Albert Einstein's admonition that the formulation of a problem is often more essential than its solution. Ackerman said this, some stage in a judge's reasoning process, the judge will come to a preliminary conclusion as to what the result would be. And I suggest the best way to test this is to attempt to falsify it. See if you can drive yourself away from this conclusion. He says, my experience is that one can easily become trapped into a certain sort of tunnel vision, that you end up rehearsing the same line of reasoning over and over again, always looking around for authority to confirm what you want to do rather than to see if there's any authority that will refute it. He says, it is in this context that foreign law can play a particularly valuable role. It may be that when one commences the inquiry into foreign law, one is psychologically hoping to find confirmation for one's hypothesis. But if one remains alive to falsifying possibilities, where the foreign law teaches, you know, that was a dumb idea to go through the case in that way. You should go through it in this other way. Then that foreign law can be of particular value. I mean, these are very vague comments by Justice Ackerman, but I find this attitude rather more attractive than the view of Justice Kennedy, which says that we just look to foreign authority for confirmation of our own liberal impulses. All right. One thing that my scientific analogy, so the scientific consensus is rather like the jus scientiae. One thing that my scientific analogy is dependent upon is a view of law as in large measure a matter of reason, rather than a matter of will. As Herbert Wechsler wrote in his Neutral Principles essay, those who perceive in law only the element of fiat will not join gladly in the search for standards of the kind I have in mind. If you think that legal conundrums and problems are ultimately solved in a simple Alexandrian fashion, just cutting through the Gordian knot with an act of will, with a determination just to privilege this particular value or just to privilege, promote this particular policy, then maybe you will be uninterested in the exigencies of a jurisprudence that talks about patient analysis. the untangling of abstract issues, the ascertaining of just resolutions, and the learning and cooperation that is characteristic of a scientific approach. Approaching law as a matter of fiat, you will not see any reason why expressions of will elsewhere in the world should affect our expressions of will in America. For you, the question is, who is to be master? And you will see in the citation of foreign law nothing much than more than Justice Scalia saw, the subjective views of five members of this court and like-minded foreigners. I've tried to present law in a different light as essentially a problem-solving enterprise. And even in areas where law is governed entirely and properly by democratic decision, I still don't see it as a matter of will. I don't believe, for one thing, in the idea of a unitary will of the people. And I don't even think that individual voting should be construed as mere expression of will. What I think is that in these areas, when there's reasonable disagreement on some issue, each person has a right to have respect accorded to his or her reason, and to have equal weight assigned to his or her reasoned conclusion. And that's what we do when we count votes. We're not just sort of giving weight to people's wills. We're doing it roughly in the same way that we count votes in a court. We're giving respect to the reasoning on an equal basis. Still reason that we're talking about, and reason will not refuse assistance when others have been wrestling with what we too are trying to figure out. Some have expressed surprise that I think this is true of the Constitution of all things. Law may be a matter of reason, they say, but surely the Constitution is the domain of will and historical contingency and of the identity that we, the people, have decided to shape for ourselves. I'm not sure that I accept that point even about the structural Constitution. It seemed to me that we reasoned our way to the constitutional structures that we treasure with a lot of help from foreigners. And I certainly don't accept the point so far as the rights jurisprudence of the Constitution is concerned. There, as I said yesterday, it's not only possible but necessary to see our Bill of Rights as an attempt to get at the fundamental rights that people are supposed to have anyway, and thus to answer more or less the same difficult question that other countries are asking when they wonder what should be put in their fundamental charters of rights. I had a conversation with some JSD students this morning, and one of them, Orr Basak, said to me, but look, in the United States in particular, there does seem to be a very strong identification with the Constitution as part of national identity, almost a sort of civic religion of the Constitution. And I wasn't prepared to dissent from that, but again, it didn't seem to me to be a strong identification that was something that was exclusive or something that was necessarily hostile to outside influences. The analogy I used in conversation to him was to think of countries that identify very strongly, say, with Roman Catholicism, like the Irish Republic in the early years of its existence. They identified strongly with Roman Catholicism, but they didn't want to say, and what's more, Irish Catholicism is utterly different from other sorts of. They were identifying with something that was open, something that they knew they consciously, proudly shared in common with other communities around the world. Islamic communities do something similar. Each particular Islamic state might identify itself strongly with its Islamic law, but it does so in great consciousness that these are universal values that it shares with other communities. And when we identify very strongly with many of the features of our structural constitution and our rights constitution, the identification is enormously strong, but it's also an outward-looking identification. It's not an exclusively self-defining one. Very few people these days are relativist about rights. Why don't I write that down? It's almost certainly false, but I'm not a relativist about rights, nor is Robert. People are happy to accept that the same basic rights apply everywhere and that it's neither a bad thing nor a surprising thing that most modern bills of rights look the same. But there are still some who want to draw a line between that sort of commonality and commonality at the level of constitutional adjudication. This is going to raise the question that Dieter asked yesterday. If you'll forgive me, I'm going to take as representative of the viewer an address by Lord Hoffman, a law lord in England, delivered in 1998 at the time of the passage of Britain's Human Rights Act. Lord Hoffman said some things in that address which was intended to criticize the Europeanization of British rights jurisprudence, which did sound rather relativist. He said, we, he meant the British, have our own hierarchy of moral values, our own culturally determined sense of what is fair and unfair, and I think it would be wrong to submerge this under a pan-European jurisprudence of human rights. But he didn't mean that we believe in different rights. He agreed there was an irreducible minimum core, he meant something much more subtle, that even if our basic beliefs about rights and values are the same, there are difficult questions of application, interpretation, and balance that have to be determined according to the cultural predilections of each society. He said, we believe free speech is a good thing, we believe the administration of justice is a good thing, but there are cases where free speech and justice come into conflict with each other. He cited the case of, in England, the law grants anonymity to rape complainants, so their names can't be published in the newspapers. The newspapers over here would complain that this was a violation of free speech. You've got the question of balance here. He says, there's no right answer to that question. Any choice involves some degree of sacrifice. This is still Lord Hoffman. But in my view, the specific answers, the degree to which weight is given to one desirable objective rather than another, will be culturally determined. Different communities will adopt the answers which they think suit them. But since these are exactly the issues that courts have to grapple with, this is me now, allowing courts to be influenced by the disapproving views of foreigners would be to unacceptably pollute what are essentially the contingent cultural judgments of one community with those of another. Well, as I said to Dita yesterday, I don't accept this at all. I think we are deploying reason as much when we are balancing one right against another as we are when we are deciding in a grosser sense what basic minimum core rights we have. In fact, I would say we have to employ reason much more when we are balancing rights, because it's usually not just a question of weight like this. It's usually one of these convoluted tangles of issues that you get, for example, in the Hugo case or in the Hopkinson case. When I see Justice France figuring her way through Hopkinson, or Justice Goldstone figuring his way through the tangle of issues in Hugo, I don't get a sense of different cultures simply giving them different answers, or of the judges simply casting around to find which answers suit the ethos of their people, or which one, as it were, feels best as a matter of their own expression of the spirit of the country. The sense I get from these cases and all such cases is that the judges think there is something here to figure out. There's something here to work through. There is stage-by-stage reasoning to be done. There is articulate abstraction to be engaged in. And they welcome the opportunity to do that figuring in terms of concepts, principles, and doctrines that were made available to them as part of the heritage of mankind. If what Lord Hoffman means is that reasonable people may well come up with different answers, and I'm sure he's right, but we don't need to abandon the idea that these are issues of reason just because the reasoning of one person doesn't yield the same results as the reasoning of another. It may still be reasoning, and there are still differences between doing it carelessly and doing it well, doing it quickly and doing it slowly, doing it paying attention to all the issues as opposed to doing it paying attention only to some, doing it with a sensible pathway through the tangle as opposed to an impulsive pathway through the tangle. I think it's very close to time to stop, but just bear with me for a few more minutes while I try and... We're at the section where it says some concluding evasions on this. So here are the concluding evasions. I said on Monday that the controversy about the citation of foreign law has been so great that bills have been introduced into Congress to outlaw this practice. The Constitution Restoration Bill, in its current Senate version, says, Section 201, in interpreting and applying the Constitution of the United States, a court of the United States may not rely upon any constitution, law, policy, or decision, or judicial decision of a foreign state or international organization, other than English common law up until the time of the adoption of the Constitution of the United States. Like me, you may find it intriguing that the most vociferous opponent of the use of foreign legal authority on the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, has reacted negatively to this legislative proposal. I have something here from the Washington Post, which reported a speech he gave to the National Italian American Foundation, which included many members of Congress of Italian descent. It's none of your business, Scalia said, referring to Congress. No one is more opposed to the use of foreign law than I am, but I'll be darned if I think it's up to Congress to direct the court how to make its decisions. Let us make our little mistakes just as we let you make yours. So even though he agreed with the motivation, he was furiously wanted to resist there being this sort of political pressure. Justice Scalia has confronted what he called the bothersome application of political pressure against the court before. I think it was in his dissent in Planned Parenthood against Casey. He said this: "The American people are not fools. As long as the people thought that we justices were doing essentially lawyers' work up here, they pretty much left us alone. But if in reality our process of constitutional adjudication consists primarily of making value judgments, then a free and intelligent people's attitudes towards us can be expected to be quite different. People know that their value judgments are quite as good as those taught in any law school, maybe even better. Okay? As long as the people thought we were doing essentially lawyers' work up here." Whatever you think of Justice Scalia, and I think very highly of him, the contrast between lawyers' work and the indulgence of value preferences is clearly an important one. Scalia has tried to represent the citation of foreign law as just a cover for value preferences, the subjective views of five justices and like-minded foreigners. But what I've tried to do in these lectures is to represent the citation of foreign law as something more like what Justice Scalia called lawyers' work. Though no doubt it is used opportunistically, at its best, the citation of foreign law could represent the accessing of what I've called the body of principles and doctrines that are comprised in the Jus Gentium. And that could be a way of fulfilling the deeper allegiance that lawyers and judges owe to the ideal of legality. That's what I talked about at the very end of Monday's lecture. The deeper allegiance that we owe to the idea of legality, to the rule of law, and to the principle that we are a nation under laws, not men. I began with that motto from Justinian that you have at the top of your song sheet there. And every people subject to laws and customs, every people subject to the rule of law, uses partly its own law, partly laws common to all mankind. I've given you, or tried to give you, three ways of thinking about that in terms of traditional lawyers' work. And we can paraphrase the passage from the Institutes in three ways. Here's the first, from Monday. "Every people subject to the rule of law goes deep into its own law and deep into the heritage of law generally to find what we call principles to inform, moderate, and sustain the application of surface-level rules that they enforce." That was the lesson of Riggs against Palmer on Monday. Secondly, "Every people subject to the rule of law keeps faith for the sake of fairness and consistency, not just with its own judgments and precedents, but with the judgments and precedents of other courts when these can be seen as part of a common and reciprocal system or enterprise." That was the argument from Integrity yesterday. And then thirdly, today, "Every people subject to the rule of law has access not only to its own doctrinal pathways through difficult legal issues, but to the doctrines and pathways of analysis that have been found enduringly useful throughout the legal world generally in untangling conundrums and striking balances that every legal system has to confront." As I said yesterday, I'm very conscious that the arguments I've given by no means establish a cast iron case for any of this, for this idea of the Jus Gentium, this notional repository of principle, analogy, and technique that is made available to lawyers the world over on the basis of having been tested in the positive experience of many particular legal systems. But I wanted this to be suggestive of deeper and more substantial ways of thinking about the foreign law controversy than just simply saying we can learn something, we can't learn something, back and forth in that way. Deeper and more substantial ways of thinking about the foreign law controversy. And I hope it does open up a number of ways in which jurisprudence, properly informed by a history of our tradecraft, may have a useful bearing on this most challenging issue. Thank you very much indeed.